Over the past few weeks, we have been doing a series called Gift and Task, where we've been exploring the idea that life is a gift to be fully lived and enjoyed and savored, and that life is also a task. Life requires something from us, effort, work, and sacrifice. And so we've been looking at how we hold together these key aspects of life that on the surface can sometimes seem at odds with each other. But when we look more closely, we start to realize that they're actually complementary. So this morning's theme is salt and light. And so together I'm hoping to unpack some ideas around what it might look like for us to move beyond sometimes that very modern, hyper-individualistic approach to faith that is centered around my salvation, my quiet time, my relationship with God, into a faith that also incorporates something more communal and outward in nature. We're starting in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus said, "You, beloved, are the salt of the earth. But if salt becomes bland and loses its saltiness, can anything make it salty again? No, it is useless, it's tossed out, thrown away, or trampled. And you, beloved, are the light of the world. A city built on a hilltop cannot be hidden. Similarly, it would be silly to light a lamp and then hide it under a bowl. When someone lights a lamp, they put it on a table, a desk, or a chair, and the light illumines the entire house. You are like that illuminating light. Let your light shine everywhere you go, that you may illumine creation, so that men and women everywhere may see your good actions, may see creation at its fullest, may see your devotion to me, and may turn and praise your Father in heaven because of it." And so we have here this beautiful picture of a spirituality that moves beyond private belief and becomes something alive and participatory within the world around us. Now, I do need to do a little disclaimer here. Even though I have spent the majority of my adult life working for a church, I do not have a single evangelistic bone in my body. Can anyone else relate to that? There's, you know, those fivefold ministry type tests you can do where you're finding out if you're an apostle or a prophet or a teacher or a pastor. And when I have taken those tests, evangelist doesn't even register on my results. The thought of going into public and sharing the good news with strangers makes me want to renounce my faith altogether. It's not for me. And so I think part of what has caused this recoil at the thought of evangelism is that it was done really badly in our earlier years. Can anyone relate to that? So for me growing up, my understanding of evangelism was that you were out handing out tracts to drunk people on a Friday night. Perhaps street preaching, or my particular favourite, doing a dramatic skit or a dance. It usually involved some sort of move like this, where the person was being torn between Jesus or the devil or my boyfriend or alcohol, or, you know, it was cool. You had to be there. Okay, there was also like really weird and dodgy theology teaching us that for every person you got saved, you would get an extra jewel in your heavenly crown. Did anyone else have that one? Yeah. And I remember as a child just worrying about having eternal shame in heaven because my crown probably wasn't going to have any jewels in it. And so evangelism was just this really tricky thing where we were expected to put ourselves out there in ways that felt embarrassing and ill-fitting. because that's what Jesus required of us. And so we denied ourselves and we picked up our cross and we performed bad skits. And we assumed that faithfulness required a suppressing of our personal wiring. And so instead of becoming a holy, whole, and wholesome, spirit-formed people whose presence helped to flavor and preserve, or whose light helped to illuminate the world, we became awkward salespeople for Jesus. And now, I would hate for this to come across as though that I think those more direct forms of evangelism are bad or unnecessary. I assume that most of us are here today because somebody shared the good news of Jesus with us. In fact, what I will say is that some people are absolutely wired for a bold type of evangelism. They are compelled and motivated and gifted to share their faith in really bold ways. My mother-in-law is one of these peoples, and she has the most amazing stories about times where she shared Jesus with people. And she recently shared a story with me about a time when she was out on the street trying to connect with people so she could talk to them about Jesus. And so her method was that she would bake cookies. They're very good. She would bake cookies and hand them out to people. And while she did that, she would also ask if they wanted a printout copy of her testimony. And so one day she was out there handing out her cookies, and she'd offered one to this young girl. And as she did it, this girl, she burst into tears and just opened up and started telling my mother-in-law about all her tricky circumstances, and that that particular morning she'd had her baby taken from her. And so my mother-in-law asked her if she wanted her to pray with her that God would help her, and she said yes. And so they did that, and she shared with her a simple gospel message. And then the girl hopped on the back of a motorbike with some man and rode off. She stayed out on the street, you know, for a little while longer. And later on, she heard the sound of a motorbike roaring back up the street. And this young girl had come back and she called out, "Thank you, I got my baby back." Now, I do not know what happened in between those windows of time, but it was just this beautiful moment for her. And then many years later, my mother-in-law was getting ready for church on a Sunday morning, and she felt this unusual prompting by God to attend a church that she didn't typically go to. And while she was there, she had a lady come up to her and say, "Do you remember me? I was that girl on the motorbike that you prayed for all those years ago." And she went on to tell her that after getting her baby back, she decided that she needed to get her life in order. So she ditched the motorbike guy, and she started attending church. And then she met a lovely Christian guy, and they married and had a family. So I will say that I genuinely admire people who share their faith boldly. And I also understand that I am not less faithful or a bad Christian because I don't do it in the same way. I'm simply wired differently. And I think sometimes where we go wrong is in assuming that faithfulness requires us to disconnect from who we are. But living our faith outwardly is not about overriding our wiring, but about allowing who we are to be formed and animated by the Spirit in ways that bring life and truth to others. Galatians 5, this is a well-known verse. "The Holy Spirit produces in us a different kind of fruit: unconditional love, joy, peace, patience, kind-heartedness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. You won't find any law opposed to fruit like this. Those of us who belong to the anointed one, have crucified our old lives and put to death the flesh and all the lusts and desires that plague us. Now, since we have chosen to walk with the Spirit, let's keep each step in perfect sync with God's Spirit. And so what we see here is Paul painting a picture of the spiritual life as one of formation. Not the suppression of self, nor the assumption that we have nothing to change, but the forming of a more holy, whole, and wholesome self. And so slowly, without erasing who we are, the Spirit begins forming us into people who carry more love, more joy, more patience, more gentleness. This gradual fruit of a life being formed by God. Our wiring doesn't disappear, but it slowly becomes softened or refined and brought into greater alignment with the life of the Spirit. And so I think this is an aspect of what it means to be salt and light, not by becoming someone else, but becoming more fully ourselves as we are formed by the Spirit, people who carry love and hope and truth into the world around us. And now, as I've listened throughout this teaching series, I keep noticing this underlying theme of balance. Life is a gift and a task. We had Dion's sermon a little while ago. He did an amazing sermon on faith versus works. And so there's been this reoccurring pattern of things that can initially seem to pull against each other, but actually when held in balance with each other, something healthier emerges. And so the goal isn't to choose one and reject the other, but to learn how to hold both well. And so this idea of balance reminded me of a conversation I had a few years ago. I had a friend who was kind of deconstructing their faith, and they eventually had decided that they were an atheist. There were just things didn't add up enough for them to believe anymore. And so I remember running into them a few years later, and they said, "Well, I don't know if I'd call myself a full atheist anymore." And they went on to say something about, you know, for them, there's something about the way that gravity holds us all at the right distance from the sun and keeps the planets perfectly orbiting and all this stuff, something about Newton's law and homeostasis. And there was this idea of a universe following these precise laws of balance. And all of this kind of pointed them towards something, definitely not God, but maybe some sort of intentional higher intelligence behind it all. And so throughout history, we see different cultures and schools of thought recognizing something similar, that there seems to be an order woven into reality. In ancient wisdom traditions like the Tao Te Ching, forgive me if I said that incorrectly, there's this idea that reality has a grain to it, and that when you move with it, life tends to flow. And when you live out of alignment, friction increases. Their idea is that the difficulties we face are not punishments, but merely feedback that something is imbalanced. Aristotle taught that both excess and deficiency distort what is good, and that virtue exists in balance. In the Hebrew scriptures, their biblical and theological beliefs didn't frame sin as breaking the rules, but as being out of alignment with the way of God. Books like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes assume that reality itself has a moral structure to it, that actions have consequences because life has an order and a wisdom woven into it. And so across science and nature and philosophy and theology, we see this reoccurring pattern of rhythm and order and balance. And when we live too far out of alignment with that order, eventually we begin to feel a cost, not as punishment, but as an invitation back into balance. And so one of the most common patterns that we see in healthy systems is this movement between input and output. Our bodies are designed this way. We breathe in, we breathe out. We eat, we excrete. We move and we rest. And we know that when we overconsume or underfunction, eventually things become unhealthy. And the same is true of our spiritual lives. Our faith becomes imbalanced when it only flows inward. And so this can look like a spirituality where God exists mainly to meet our needs or to bless our endeavors and to fulfill our desires, where the focus stays primarily on ourselves and our own lives. But a spirituality that never moves beyond the self eventually becomes imbalanced. A healthy spirituality requires both receiving and giving, inward formation as well as outward participation. We see in the creation story in Genesis this pattern of gift and task. It says, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. So we see God first blessing them and then instructing them to work and take responsibility for what has been given. In the parable of the talents, servants are entrusted with significant amounts of money to steward. Again, the same pattern of gift and participation. And one thing I find interesting in this parable is that when the master returns, his invitation isn't simply into more work and more responsibility, but into joy. Matthew 25, it says, his master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little, and I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And so this parable seems to suggest that as we participate, we somehow become more fully alive and share in God's joy. But I'm sure there are plenty of you here today thinking, nah, I've been there and I've done that and I've got emotional scars to prove it. And I think that's valid. This can be a really sensitive subject for people because for a lot of us, words like serving, responsibility, and participation have often become emotionally tangled up with pressure and guilt and exhaustion. I have my own experience with this that actually didn't originate in the church, but in my home growing up. Now, I am truly grateful for so much of my upbringing, but when it came to learning personal responsibility and self-discipline, the approach in my household felt more of a hindrance than a help. Some of you may have had this too, where chores felt like punishments. Forgetting things often meant getting in trouble. And so for me as a child, this whole dynamic felt intense. It felt like a daily source of failure and criticism. It was something that I had to shield myself from rather than something I was being helped or coached into. I will acknowledge that I think my particular wiring made me extra sensitive to this kind of environment, and I hope it doesn't sound more dramatic than it was. But as a result, even now as an adult, I have to work very hard at separating certain types of normal adult responsibility from a childhood sense of feeling harmed. And so now with our own kids, we're trying to do this differently. Definitely not perfectly, but we are trying to create a culture where contribution and responsibility aren't brought about through shame and punishment, but through encouragement as they grow into it. Because in safe and healthy environments, contributing should feel meaningful and life-giving. And what I know about the nature of God is that he is not inviting people into those old oppressive systems of harm and of obligation, but he is inviting us to slowly expand beyond self-protection and to become people who are more open to others, more available to love, and more willing to participate in the healing and restoration of the world around us. 2 Corinthians describes it like this. Therefore, if anyone is united with the Anointed One, that person is a new creation. The old life is gone, and see, a new life has begun. All of this is a gift from our Creator God, who has pursued us and brought us into a restored and healthy relationship with him through the Anointed. And he has given us the same mission, the ministry of reconciliation, to bring others back to him. It is central to our good news that God was in the Anointed making things right between himself and the world. This means he does not hold their sins against them. But it also means he charges us to proclaim the message that heals and restores our broken relationship with God and each other. So, we are now representatives of the Anointed One, the liberating King. God has given us a charge to carry through our lives, urging all people on behalf of the Anointed to become reconciled to the Creator God. And so this is not a picture of a private spirituality, but of people participating in God's restorative work in the world. I was at a seminar for church leaders recently, and a question was asked, do you know people who might need Jesus that you are regularly praying for? There were more questions. Do you know people who might be open to an invitation to come to church with you or whose kid might want to come along to youth group? And I thought, actually, I have so many people I could be praying for or inviting into community. And I realized that because I don't consider myself very evangelistic, I'd quietly excused myself from participating at all. Now, maybe you are the kind of person who comes alive sharing the gospel in divinely appointed moments. Maybe you love praying for strangers, or you love having deep spiritual conversations on airplanes. Maybe you love talking to people about Jesus every chance you get. And honestly, good for you. I thank God for people like you. That's beautiful. But maybe for you, participation looks quieter, more relational, or more practical. And maybe it looks like becoming a little less guarded, a little less self-protected. Maybe it looks like being more present and patient with your kids. Maybe it's about becoming a less prickly person in your workplace, or being the kind of person who listens empathetically when someone is struggling. Maybe it looks like responding to that quiet prompting from the Holy Spirit to text someone, or to initiate a conversation, or to encourage someone, or to pray for someone, or to invite someone for dinner. Maybe it looks like making meals for people when their lives fall apart, or mowing someone's lawns when they're overwhelmed, helping fix someone's car, cleaning a house for a friend who is drowning a little, donating food to the food bank and pajamas for kids in need, helping someone move house, paying for someone's groceries, giving someone a lift, watching a friend's kids so they can breathe for a minute, buying a meal for someone living on the street. Maybe it looks like helping with youth group, joining a church roster twice a term, opening up your home, getting involved in prison ministry, volunteering somewhere uncomfortable, coaching a kid's sports team, creating safe spaces for people, being generous with your money, becoming someone who apologizes first, extending grace to people who let you down, reconciling relationships instead of avoiding them. Maybe it looks like making genuine friendships with other parents at school pickup, or learning the names of your neighbors, checking in on the lonely person, sitting with someone in grief, becoming more patient, more peaceful, more emotionally healthy, more open-hearted. Maybe witness is not always overt. Maybe sometimes it looks like a life that is slowly becoming alive to God and more available to others and more willing to participate in the healing and restoration of the world around us.